The community of Winder, Georgia, and beyond, in fact, the whole nation, is again in mourning, once again traumatized, because children, babies, are dead due to gun violence. This time it happened at Appalachie High School in Georgia, where a shooting at a school left two students and two teachers dead at the time of this recording, and many more injured. And once again, we as a nation are saying thoughts and prayers aren't enough. But what is enough? What can change the fact that in the United States of America, gun violence is the number one cause of death of people between the ages of 5 and 17. I want to say that again. In America, guns are the number one killer of children. We in the United States have more deaths of our children by gunfire than any other developed nation. There's got to be a solution to that. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is Justice by Design, where we look at some of the most pressing issues in our society and talk to the people who are rolling up their sleeves to find a solution to those problems. And that's why today I am so very, very grateful to be joined today by Josh Horowitz, who is the Dana Feitler Professor in Gun Violence Prevention and Advocacy and Distinguished Professor of Practice at Johns Hopkins University. Josh, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me at this somewhat sad time. So that's an important discussion to have.
It really is. So before we get started, I want you to introduce yourself a little bit for our listeners and tell us what you do there at Johns Hopkins.
Well, I'm the co-director of the Center for Gun Violence Solutions at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. I'm a professor there as well. So I work on gun violence prevention research and advocacy, and I also teach. Coming to Johns Hopkins 2.5 years ago, I worked in an advocacy organization for over 30 years, and I've been deeply involved in the gun violence prevention space, including, you know, obviously, unfortunately, personal experience with this and working with families who have lost people who have died and caring passionately about this issue, but making sure that we also think about the research and making sure that the research fully informs our advocacy.
All right. So I want to talk about that in the research. Usually on this podcast, I spend a little time, you know, fleshing out what the issue is before we get to the solutions. But I think in this case, we really don't have to flesh anything more out. We see right in front of us that not just in mass shootings, but also inside the home, just the fact that guns kill more kids than any other cause in this country is really all you need to know about the problem. But I think it's helpful in this case that we have a situation that happened in Georgia that highlights so many of the points of where solutions can be found, that I want to sort of use that as an entry point, because there are different kinds of solutions that have been proposed. You studied this and you know what works and what doesn't. So I want to start with the fact that the firearm that was used in this shooting was an AR-15. There has been a lot of discussion about changing policy in this country to make those guns just inaccessible to civilians. The fact that a 14-year-old, and we'll get to his age later, was able to get his hands on such a high-powered rifle, what do we do about that? What works and what doesn't?
Let me take a step back, because I love the name of your show, Justice by Design, and the system that we have that allows a 14-year-old to have a semi-automatic rifle with an AR platform is by design. So no one should think this is sort of like an accident or how did this happen? It happens because we designed the system, not us, but there are people who have designed the system to allow for 14-year-olds to have access to high-capacity weapons, handguns, long guns, AR-15-style weapons. And so how does that happen? Well, it happens because we don't have a limit on magazine capacity in the United States, and certainly not in Georgia. We don't have a limitation on possession of rifles by 14-year-olds in Georgia. We don't have a strong safe storage process in Georgia. We do not have a red flag law in Georgia. We don't have background checks in Georgia. We have easy access to concealed carry without a permit in Georgia. So what is Georgia? Georgia is one of the leading states for gun violence death, both by homicide and suicide. I'm just going to throw out, we talked a little bit about statistics. Georgia's death rate by firearms is 20 per 100,000. Rhode Island is under 4. Rhode Island has all the laws I just mentioned. That's not by accident. That's by design.
So let's start with the firearms then, because I know there has been a broader debate about whether restricting the focus in any sort of gun reform should be on what weapons are available versus who gets them. I think there should be some of both, but let's talk about the weapons, AR-15s. What can we do about access and still protect the rights of people who want to be law-abiding gun owners?
Right. So I think there's a couple of things that we need to do. The evidence around these weapons is it's the high-capacity magazine that increases lethality. Now, morally, I think AR-15s are horrible. I think they're designed for the battlefield. But when we think about policy, the first thing we want to do is think about limiting magazine capacity. We don't know what happened in the shot. I don't know with the capacity, but we often see high-capacity magazines used in AR-15s or in semi-automatic pistols to make them more deadly. So developing policy around magazine capacity around all platforms of weapons, of firearms, is really an important goal of our center. And we think that's really clearly where the evidence is, that access to high-capacity magazines in a weapon like an AR-15 is what makes it so deadly. Now, I've shot AR-15s before. It makes, you know, someone like me who's a very casual, occasionally shooter feel like I can hit anything with it. So it's a deadly platform. But the fact that you can do that with a high capacity magazine inserted in that weapon is what really creates the lethality. And that's where I believe that we need to focus. I'm no fan of AR-15s, but if I had to choose, I would say let's get rid of those high capacity magazines first.
Okay. And we also have a situation where this individual who's 14 years old, I just can't imagine that. You know, I have a little niece who's 14, and she was, when I saw her, she was trying to teach me a TikTok dance. I mean, just thinking that's what 14-year-olds, you want them to be doing, not having access to these firearms, but that he had actually last year when he was 13 been reported to law enforcement based on an alleged threat that he made to engage in a mass shooting. So at that point, no charges were filed and nothing was done, even though the law enforcement knew that the father owned an AR-15. So I know we talk a little bit about red flag laws. I'm not sure if this fits directly in that, but what can be done in a situation like that?
Let's talk about two pieces of this because they go together. One is, so you've got law enforcement coming to the house because of threats, and you have someone who owns, sound like potentially a whole variety of weapons, who is not obligated to safely and store those weapons. That's a huge problem. It should be a very clear requirement that you have to keep your weapons, all of your weapons, locked in a safe. That's the only safe way to do it. Right. And since it's the only safe way to do it, it should be required. And some states have that. But Georgia does not have a strong child access prevention law. And that's a problem. So even if law enforcement came in, there's a threat. They think there's threat. The father is under no obligation to lock their firearms in Georgia. That's a problem. Number two, if law enforcement comes in and says, wow, there's a threat here, the father isn't locking up the guns, can we use what we call technically an extreme risk protection order, ERPO, often referred to as red flag laws. And that allows law enforcement to go to a court and say, we're getting threats. The father's not storing the guns. Can we just hold these guns for safekeeping for a year or 6 months till this crisis passes? Right? Georgia doesn't have that law. Okay. 21 states in the District of Columbia, including their neighbor Florida, has that law. And law enforcement, I've talked to them and they say to me, Josh, this is the first time that we've felt proactive in our ability to stop shootings. Why won't Georgia enact that? This is a civil protection order that allows the temporary removal of a firearm with judicial oversight, and the gun goes back after just over, depending on the law, but between 6 and 12 months. These are important tools. And can you imagine law enforcement having to go into that home and saying, well, the guns, I mean, we don't know, I'm just speculating, but certainly potentially guns not locked up, the child making threats, not a crime yet, but they can just see it. They see everything that's going on, what's going to happen. And what they say is, well, unfortunately, and the FBI said this, we didn't have probable cause for a crime. But what about, did they have probable cause to believe that the shooter was going to be violent with a firearm? Then they could have removed a firearm. They could have gone to a judge. This is all with judicial oversight. And just said, let's get the most lethal means out of this child's hands because the father won't do it. Now, a fair amount of speculation here, but I know from cases around the country that we see this, where children, there's guns in the home, the parents are not as responsible as you like, and so that gun needs to get out of the home. And by the way, this applies in many other situations than for children, right? This can apply to in something that we see in Georgia, which is a high suicide rate. Most of these extreme risk laws are actually used for suicide. What increases, what's the most likely factor for increasing the risk of death for a suicide? It's a firearm in the home, right? And that's my personal experience, is a dear friend of mine died because of easy access to firearms, right? And, you know, if we had access to an ERPO back then, that was over 30 years ago, I would have used it. And I know that, or tried to get used. And I know so many family members who go to law enforcement, or in some states can even do it themselves, who said, this is too big a risk. So Georgia has a high overall death rate, but they have a high suicide rate as well. So this is a law that research shows, as we have a developing research base, saves lives regularly, right?
And both of these, and both of these measures are so important because of what you're talking about. In this instance, we're talking right after a mass shooting, and those are the ones that get the headlines. Whereas most shooting deaths are not in mass shootings. Most of them happen in the home because there is a gun, there is a gun that isn't secured, so either a child can get to it. We've seen videos of children who see a gun and are, you know, playing with it like it's a toy, or other people can get to it, or it can be stolen, or it can, in the heat of the moment, be quickly accessed because it isn't locked up. Well, you know, that's the number to me. It's like, you want to be a responsible gun owner, lock up your firearms.
Right, and there should be no disagreement about this. Right. So most firearm deaths are suicides with access. Right. And so that's often with a home locus. Right. And what we know is that school shooters under 18, strong majority of them get their firearms from home or from an unsecured relative. Can we do better than that? I mean, we have a society that relentlessly, Georgia says guns make you safe. They do not. That is clear. That doesn't mean that every gun owner is a problem, or every firearm in a home. That's not what we're saying. There's a way to do this responsibly. And the states that have done that, you think about Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and more and more California. Mm-hmm. These states who have worked hard on these laws save lives every day, and they have safe storage, extreme risk laws. Another big piece is we haven't talked about is permit to purchase laws or license. Just makes sense to get a license to have a firearm. These things save lives. And at our center, we have the sort of five that save lives. So you have a license. You have things like firearm removal, extreme risk protection orders, domestic violence protection orders. Number three, safe storage. Number four, limiting public access to firearms. Number five, fully funding community violence intervention. And we think if we did all those things, we'd reduce gun violence 30% by 2030. And I ask you to look at the difference between Georgia, which is 20 deaths per 100,000 again, and states like Rhode Island, Massachusetts, where under 4 per 100,000. And you see, like, wow, we could save lives. We are just not doing it. And that's by design.
Yeah. So I will say one thing. I know people who live in Massachusetts who are hunters, who are very avid gun owners, and they can do it. They can do it in Massachusetts and follow all of the rules. So I get a bit irate when people say, well, this is trampling on the Second Amendment rights. No, the Second Amendment can be alive and well, and you can own guns. And if you lock them up and you care for them, you know, if you're responsible with them, you can have your guns. This is what I'm trying to, it seems very clear, and it just really shows the that how false that reasoning is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I couldn't agree with you more. I spent a fair amount of time in Massachusetts, and there's plenty of people shooting, plenty of people target practicing, going hunting, the whole nine.
Yeah.
You know, and we have a much safer place. So there's so much we can do, and it's just going back to the human side of this, you just feel, I mean, the tragedy of this, you don't know we have no idea if, you know, in this particular instance, you know, if a law could have stopped it, but you know that but overall, you see so much more death in a state like Georgia. And for those to say, well, we just need to harden our targets. I mean, you know, there's obviously some technology that were used in that school that helped, but four people are dead. There were school resources officers on the scene in 120 seconds. So that's just, to me, unacceptable. We need multiple approaches to these things. And one of them has to be stronger gun laws.
Absolutely. And one other thing to your point about the human part of this, even in places like Massachusetts that have the so-called red flag laws that allow either law enforcement or sometimes family members, physicians to alert the police and get an order. It will still require a judge's order to get a firearm temporarily removed from the home. They don't work because people don't know about it, right? Or people are reluctant to use it, right? It can't be there. I think there needs to be so much more awareness about the fact that if you know somebody who is presenting a danger and they have access to a gun, you should know that you can go to law enforcement. The worst thing that happens is they investigate and say there's nothing you could do, but at least make that step. And people don't even realize that that's the law.
You're so right. In our center, we spend a lot of time educating people, but it needs to be a nationwide, all hands on deck effort here, especially two things: for states that have it, to educate people, starting with law enforcement, and then all the different types of, you know, healthcare providers and judges and things like that. But in states that don't have it, we obviously need to have it, to need to implement it and enact it. But yeah, I mean, there's 21 states in the District of Columbia, and there's still tragedies that happen in those states, and they can be prevented if we had better access and better knowledge about extreme risk laws. And that's, you know, you can go to our website and learn more about that. We're the Center for Gun Violence Solutions. But it has to be something that community members take upon themselves as well.
And we will drop that website in the show notes as well for our listeners can, so our listeners can find it there. Now, I just want to talk briefly about one other proposed solution to this before we talk about other things like legislation that's been passed in the Supreme Court. But the solution of, you know, the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is for a good guy to have a gun. There is a push to require teachers to carry, or allow teachers to carry guns in the classroom. What do you think about that solution? What's the data show?
Well, I think, you know, the data shows that access to firearms increases death, and especially, you know, for teachers, there's been so far no evidence that arming teachers helps anybody other than makes teaching more difficult. And, you know, you see teachers all over the country saying, I'm here to teach. It's not my job to secure the school. And also just think about the responsibility asking teachers to bring a gun into a situation where in Georgia, approximately, you know, a little more than 50% of gun deaths are actually suicides. So you're going to bring a gun into a situation where, for instance, in high school, high schoolers can get into anything, right? Young kids can get into anything. You are actually bringing the most deadly vector intentionally into the school for people who are already having, you know, in their lives, people can be, you know, all sorts of issues going on in high school. And you're going to say, okay, well, I'll lock it up. But you know what? Law enforcement forgets to lock their guns up. Sometimes they leave it in the restroom, things like that. We see it all the time. These are people who don't have the training, don't think about guns every day. It just sounds to me like a terrible, terrible idea. And I personally believe that every school system, this is my personal belief, but just needs to assess what their safety plan looks like. And I say this as someone who's on the PTA, and that was like years ago when my daughter was there. But we have our own safety plans, and each community needs to understand the risks, understand whether they want to have law enforcement in the school or not. But what I do know is that arming teachers doesn't help anything.
Yeah, I also think, and the point that you made about suicide is so incredibly important, but I also recall being a student in schools where there were, a member or two of the staff that I would be uncomfortable just to be alone with.
Yeah.
And let alone knowing that that person is armed, the potential there for the increasing that power dynamic is just really frightening to me. So let's talk about some laws. We talked last a couple of years ago in an NPR segment, and it was right after the first piece of legislation in some 30 years on gun control had been passed. So now that we will tell us a little bit about what that did, and do we have any data now as to whether or not it's working?
Well, it's still a little early to, to collect that type of causal data. We know that there's lots of new programs that are out there. We know, for instance, there's the law did a number of important things. It enhanced background checks for people under between 18 and 21. It provided lots of resources for extreme risk law implementation, which where is that's going on very well. It created the first time the first trafficking, believe it or not, there was no federal gun trafficking. Federal gun trafficking crime before, so we know people are being prosecuted. We know that there's lots of people who are being getting enhanced background checks, and people being stopped from purchasing firearms. We know that there was a historic investment in community violence intervention programs, and in mental and community mental health clinics. So it's a historic amount of focus on gun violence. There's still a lot more to do with this, but it also made it harder to sell guns, like at a gun show. So what it did is it took people who were selling lots of guns but were not federally licensed, therefore did not have to do a background check, into the category of licensed dealer. They have to apply for a licensed dealer, even if they're, lower threshold, so it makes them do background checks. So it's really too early to tell. There's been some good news. So during the height of the pandemic, we saw record levels of gun violence. We don't have the full data set, so I'm hesitant to talk about this, but we have seen certainly in homicide, it looks like there's some reduction in on firearm homicide. Unfortunately, we're still at record numbers of suicide. But I do think, for instance, the community violence intervention resources that are there, some of the work around that we're actually involved with, some of the work around extremist protection order implementation is going quite well. We're seeing people being prosecuted for federal gun trafficking crimes. We're seeing more people having to do background checks. So, at a center like ours, where I don't do the research, but I have some of the world's best researchers right next to me, we need time to study this, and we're looking at this. We're really looking at this, but there's some very important findings that we're making that are centered where the this impacts that. And so we're, I will just say that a new study that just came out about extremist protection orders from Jeff Swanson at Duke has confirmed the idea that for approximately every between every 10 and 20 extremist protection order law issue orders that are issued, one life is saved. And we're seeing an uptick in the use of extremist laws, so we know lives are being saved. I don't have the causal as much causal data as we want to be sort of definitive about what percentage this looks like, but it was a big moment. Lots more to be done, but it was a big moment that really mattered. And I think it showed that when the conditions are po politically right, people really do want these types of solutions. I will say one thing. We do our own polling at our center, and these solutions are extremely popular. So from a political perspective, the idea of making sure that domestic violence abusers don't have access to firearms, or people who threat to themselves because of suicidal impulse don't have access to firearms, licensing access to firearms, these things are extremely popular. So what we're seeing is effective laws that are popular. So I think, hopefully the conditions will be such in the future that we can build on the Safer Communities Act that was passed in 2022.
Yeah, and one of the conditions that would have to be is a Supreme Court that let some of these laws stand. Again, the last time we spoke, it was right after the Supreme Court extended the right to bear arms outside of the home, striking down some laws that prevented the carrying of handguns outside of the home. Now, since then, the Supreme Court, there was another case when you're talking about the extreme risk protection orders that asked the Supreme Court to also throw out domestic violence protection orders as violative of the Second Amendment. The Supreme Court decided not to do that. At least that even that was a bridge too far for this court. But, you know, the policy, the law that backs up the policy and the data you're talking about has to withstand scrutiny by this court. How big of a problem is that?
The Bruin decision was a full employment mandate for Second Amendment litigators. So there's been huge amounts of litigation coming after the Bruin decision. And part of it is that no one understands what the Bruin framework that the court developed is unworkable. It's a, you know, text, history, and tradition. And basically what you have to do is you have to find a law that is historically sufficiently analogous. And so they threw out this carry law in New York that you were talking about because they were basically saying that there wasn't those types of restrictions at the time of the founding, right? Think about who...
There was no law saying you can't take your musket outside of your house.
So think about who was excluded from that discussion at the time of the founding and what that meant for history. Like, were we adequately recording the history of what African Americans thought about the right to keep and bear arms and what that meant to them in 1787? Or how about women, right? So women becomes a big issue in the latest case, which is the Rahimi case, which the court just decided. There, somebody who had, you know, beat up their girlfriend, shot at bystanders, was involved in 5 or 6 other shooting incidents, said, oh, but just because I have a domestic violence protection order, I can still keep my gun because if the firearm prohibition and domestic violence protection orders is, in their opinion, unconstitutional. And this, the Fifth Circuit agreed with them and rearmed a domestic abuser. Justice Department went right to the Supreme Court on that. And the argument was, well, there was no laws that prevented abusers from having guns in 1787. The court, Justice Roberts, had to confront the ridiculous decision they made in Bruin and say, look, we didn't really mean exactly what we said there. It can be just like if, and this was, they can say, well, the principle is dangerousness. In 1787, dangerous people couldn't have firearms. So the abuser's dangerous, therefore they can have a firearm. So they upheld the prohibition. But here's the thing. It was an 8-1 decision. Do you know who the dissenting judge was?
I do, but tell us.
Justice Thomas, who said, no, he wrote the Bruin decision. No, I meant that. I meant that there was no laws preventing domestic abusers in 1787, so that you can't prohibit them from having firearms. He said, I meant that, right? So, but Justice Roberts said, confronted with what the court decision was really doing, backed off. And now the lower courts are again just, okay, so Roberts says it's kind of dangerousness, you know, and Thomas says it's historical. Now the courts are going all over the place. I will just say the Fourth Circuit, which is, you know, a very relatively conservative federal court circuit, in a 14-2 en banc decision, which means all the judges get to decide, just upheld Maryland's permit to purchase law or their licensing law. And that's a very good sign. In a bad sign, we had a district court, believe it or not, on Bruin say, well, the machine gun ban is unconstitutional. Fully automatic machine gun ban is unconstitutional. That will be overturned, I'm quite confident. But
but it shows what a mess.
It's a mess.
This all is.
It's a mess. So, but here's my advice for policymakers: follow the evidence, do what makes sense, and I think the jurisprudence over the next several years will settle out in a way that if we have laws that have evidence behind them, that they will survive. And that's where I think that's where public health comes in. That's why I'm so excited for the work that we do in this aspect, which is we bring evidence to these situations so we can show if the standard that Roberts initiated is kind of dangerousness. That's what our research shows. Who's dangerous? What circumstances are dangerous? So we want to make sure that evidence is considered. That's a big piece of this. But again, for the policymakers out there, it's confusing, but go forward with what makes sense and saves lives. That's my advice.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that great little legal lesson. It's almost fit for my other podcast, hashtag Sisters in Law, but that was a great little recap of where we are.
Amazing lawyers on our team if you ever want to go deep on these things. So.
All right, great. Josh Horowitz, thank you so much. Again, I wish it was a better occasion, but this is such important information, and I really do hope our policymakers are listening. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I think one of the most important things to take from my conversation with Josh is how much people matter in solving the problem of gun violence in America, particularly when it deals with our kids. We can have all of the laws in place. We just talked about the federal law that was passed that did tighten loopholes in gun purchasing and strengthen background checks. But that alone won't fix this problem until the culture of gun ownership in this country changes. You know, I've been to a lot of places like Iceland and other countries where people probably own more guns per capita than they do in the United States, but they don't have this kind of violence, not just gun violence against children, but they don't even have the kind of crime rates that we have in the United States. This idea that guns are an American right, you know, some sort of birthright of Americans, that the Second Amendment has been elevated to the point of religion, is part of what's broken. Because that way, any of the reasonable data-backed solutions that Josh laid out today can't happen if they immediately are faced with the pushback of, well, no, because that takes my rights away. It doesn't. The Second Amendment was meant to regulate guns. It says regulate, well-regulated, right in the language itself. It was to set out how people need to be able to form a militia in the event that they need to fight against an oppressive government. That's not what's happening in America. That's not what's happening in our schools. That's not what's happening in our main streets. It's not what's happening in our homes. So the Second Amendment wasn't even meant to apply to that. But because it has been turned into this sort of religious-like rallying cry, that's why we can't get policies passed that allow reasonable gun control. And that's why we have a Supreme Court that's doing Second Amendment analysis all wrong. One day, Justice Thomas will have enough people who agree with him to really let some horrific things change, but not if we as a society change ourselves. That's this week's episode of Justice by Design. Don't forget to follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on YouTube and follow us so you don't ever miss an important discussion about the important issues that we face as a society. I'm Kim Mackin-Store. See you next week.